You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. From Kezia Weir comes this article, Justice League of Her Own. Long a leading voice in the fight for equal rights, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the only member of the Supreme Court who has transcended into a pop culture icon. The 85-year-old's workout routine is legend, as is her bench style, lace gloves, and a bejeweled jabot she wears when issuing dissents. A fan Bible dubbed her Notorious RBG. Her likeness has been emblazoned across T-shirts, tote bags, and coffee mugs. And yet, we felt that many of her fans didn't know the full story, says Betsy West, who teamed up with fellow filmmaker Julie Cohen to direct and produce RBG, a documentary that paints a substantive portrait of the woman behind the meme, in theaters this month. There are scenes from Ginsburg's cases both in front of and behind the bench. Early home videos with Marty, her late husband of 56 years, and interviews with notable friends and associates, including Gloria Steinem, Bill Clinton, and Orrin Hatch. Pictured here, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and granddaughter Clara Spira in RBG. The filmmakers had unprecedented access to Ginsburg herself, and we see her up close at home, on the lecture circuit, and at the opera. In probing interviews, Ginsburg addresses what some saw as her controversial decision not to retire during Obama's presidency, and remembers when the dean of Harvard Law School questioned why she and eight other women should take the places of male students matriculating in her 1956 class. There is also a fair bit of levity. Ginsburg works out with her Army Reservist personal trainer and rules on Kate McKinnon's impression of her on Saturday Night Live, marvelously funny. Ginsburg's tactical tenacity over the course of her nearly six-decade career comes into sharp focus here. From her years as a newly minted lawyer, she chose and argued cases in a way that would push the concept, step by step, of equality for all, West says. She wanted women to be protected by the Constitution in the same way that men are protected by the Constitution. It took strategy to do that. Now here's Sloan Crosley with this month's Hot Type column. Rachel Kushner offers up another classic. In the photo, bus station, Washington, D.C., 1966, from American Voyage, published by Real Art, by Mario Carnicelli. One woman's entire novel is Rachel Kushner's aside. A master of cultural analysis by decade, Kushner now gives us The Mars Room, published by Scribner. When the story opens, it's 2003, and Romy Hall, a former stripper and single mother, is en route to a women's correctional facility in Northern California, where she has been sentenced to two consecutive life sentences. As Romy looks back on the life that landed her there, the reader is treated to Kushner's electrifying take on the chaos of 1980s San Francisco. Mother, is that you? Joanna Cantor turns the crushing death of a parent into an urbane adventure with her debut novel, Alternative Remedies for Loss, published by Bloomsbury. The irreverent and honest Blanche McCrary Boyd is back with Tomb of the Unknown Racist, published by Counterpoint, her first novel in two decades, and the last of her trilogy about family secrets, race, and the struggle for the truth. And in true Michael Chabon style, the essays in Pops, published by Harper, explore the magic and mystery of fatherhood. In short, O Captain, Our Captain, Robin, published by Henry Holt, is Dave Itzkoff's biography of Robin Williams. Vanity Fair contributing editor Laura Jacobs gets us into first position with Celestial Bodies, published by Basic. Charles Spencer sets out to catch a king, published by William Collins, in this 17th century version of The Fugitive. It's murder and mirth in Christopher Buckley's The Judge Hunter, published by Simon and Schuster. Catch a rare glimpse of a fledgling David Attenborough in The Wild with Adventures of a Young Naturalist, published by Quercus. Patrick Chamousseau's Slave, Old Man, published by New Press, finds freedom in the forest. Mark Adams' Miscellaneous Memoir is just the tip of the iceberg, published by Dutton. William Stadium's Madame Claude, published by St. Martin's, escorts privilege to pleasure. Passion and preservation conspire in Elizabeth Barlow Rogers's Saving Central Park, published by Knopf. Richard M. Cohen puts a potential cure for MS under the microscope in Chasing Hope, published by Blue Rider. Michael Ondaatje, master of memory and supplier of suspense, returns with the post-World War II Warlight, published by Knopf. Novelist Nick Dybek can never forget The Verdun Affair, published by Scribner. Questlove whips out the wisdom and creative quest, published by Echo. Nafisa Thompson Spire's stories face forward in Heads of the Colored People, published by Atria 37 Inc. Fiction is as suspenseful as truth in Jake Tapper's The Hellfire Club, published by Little Brown. Violence heats up in Gilbert King's Beneath a Ruthless Sun, published by Riverhead. John Meacham finds The Soul of America, published by Random House. Michael Pollan rolls psychology and psychedelics in How to Change Your Mind, published by Penguin Press. Mary Carr waxes poetic in Tropic of Squalor, published by Harper. Caroline Weber's Proust Duchess, published by Knopf, offers a Madeleine of Mademoiselles. History is written in blood and ink in Marwan Hisham's Brothers of the Gun, published by One World, illustrated by Molly Crabapple. Mark Straussman's Salad Gets Dressed in The Freds, at Barney's New York Cookbook, published by Grand Central Life and Style. Lance Richardson stitches together The House of Nutter, published by Crown Archetype. John McCain rides The Restless Wave, published by Simon & Schuster. Nadine Strossen speaks Power to Hate, published by Oxford. Simon Winchester draws The Straightest Line with the Perfectionist, published by Harper. Alan Stern and David Grinspoon decipher A Demoted Planet by Chasing New Horizons, published by Picador. The city may be sinking, but living in Lydia Fasoli and Toto Bergamo Rossi's Venice, published by Rizzoli, seems swell to me. Now, this review by Bruce Handy, beat by beat. Reading Henry Alford, the most graceful of humorists, is like being in the hands of a commanding dance partner. A spin here, a dip there, the perfect landing on le mot juste as the music or sentence stops. So perhaps his new book, And Then We Danced, A Voyage into the Groove, published by Simon & Schuster, was as inevitable as it is sublime. It is, in one sense, a celebration of hoofery in all its wonder and variety, from abandon to refinement, but it is also history, investigation, memoir, and even in its smart, sly way, self-help. We tag along with Alford as he takes ballet, hip-hop, and tap lessons, dances with Twyla Tharp, visits a ballroom class for reluctant middle schoolers and another for a lively group of Alzheimer's patients. And Then We Danced is very funny, but more, it is joyful. A dance all its own.
Thank you.
Suni Grinnell writes this beauty article, Gone to Pot, A Cannabis Craze Takes Over Skincare. Puff, puff, moisturize. The healing properties of cannabis have been extolled by different cultures for centuries, but the feel-good plant is becoming increasingly mainstream in new forms in both luxury, beauty, and wellness. The herb produces many cannabinoids, the best known of which are tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, and cannabidiol, CBD. THC is known for its psychoactive properties when smoked or ingested, and is legal in some states for recreational or medicinal use. CBD, however, is the beauty industry's latest obsession. The compound won't get you high, but according to adherents, may help alleviate pain, inflammation, and anxiety. We believe we are part of a revolution, says Cindy Capobianco of Lord Jones. The former fashion executive from New York City co-founded the wellness brand in Los Angeles with her husband Robert Rosenbeck in 2016 and hasn't looked back. Lord Jones's bestseller is its body lotion, which promises to soothe stiff joints, backaches, and muscle spasms. This month, the brand debuts CBD tincture in lemon and peppermint, which aims to help with various conditions. Foria, founded in Venice Beach by Matthew Gerson, initially marketed cannabis oil for enhancing the female sexual experience. Its latest product, Flow, is a CBD vaporizer pen designed to promote a relaxed state of mind, though the chemical does not induce a high. Up Highway 1 in the San Francisco Bay Area, Vertley creates creams and lip balms using the purest forms of hemp-derived CBD. I wanted something to normalize CBD so that people weren't frightened to use it, says founder Claudia Mata. She launched the brand's popular lip butter in August 2017. We approached it like a vitamin, a small amount you get throughout the day. Another die-hard New Yorker who moved to Cali, Mata attended Oaksterdam University, America's first cannabis college. Yes, it's real. Before pursuing certification in a second herbalism program, I'm a Californian now and completely drinking the Kool-Aid, she laughs. Vertley's new relief lotion, Out Now, is intended as a spot treatment for inflammation, muscle aches, soreness, and skin irritation. On the East Coast, Pericone MD offers CBX for men, the first commercial hemp-derived treatment line. The company's latest products include a moisturizer and an aftershave. And who better to spread the gospel of cannabis than Bob Marley's daughter, Sadella? Dad called the herb the healing of the nation and believed it could bring people together, says Marley, who operates her father's brand, Marley Natural. The all-over lotion, boost, and face oil, and lip balm, which debuts this summer, contain a moisturizer that is said to reduce skin inflammation. Given the growth in the natural and organic movements, the CBD trend isn't that surprising. We are all united by a bigger goal to normalize and destigmatize this plant that we know to be incredibly effective in so many ways, says Capobianco. That's the buzz.
Thank you.
from the vanities onto the fairground. From South by Southwest to art shows on both coasts, creative forces disrupt the status quo in style. By H.W. Vail. In the photos, Crush, Solange Knowles, Bill Murray borrows handcuffs from an Austin police officer, Dev Hines, Keith Urban, Noah Cyrus, Oberhofer, and Duckworth. Since its launch in 1987, South by Southwest has evolved from a humble music showcase into a recipe for maximum pop. One part tech nerds, one part cinephiles, and a dollop of hip-hop scenesters. Season with barbecue sauce, bake in the Texan sun for 10 days, and garnish with Bill Murray in a bucket hat. This year's festival drew the stars of music's new guard, including Kalela, Billie Eilish, Crush, and Noah Cyrus, to Austin for a spectacle of talent. Every niche and subgenre was represented, from neo-soul and shoegaze to Caribbean and electro-funk, each bringing its own trends. Vintage tracksuits, punk tartan, frayed denim, and, of course, cowboy boots, all made for a polychrome parade of individual style throughout the festival. The pros networked, while fans hopped between indie punk performances and the red carpet premieres of Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs and Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. On the coast, the art world was ablaze with the Armory Show in New York City and the opening of Damien Hirst exhibition at the Gagosian Gallery in Beverly Hills. No sharks in formaldehyde to be seen. Hirst showed off a series of large-scale pointillist confections titled The Veil Paintings. The multicolored canvases sold out immediately, perhaps because they were painted by Hirst himself, rather than a cadre of assistants, or perhaps because the artist was getting back to basics. I need to go back to my original feelings about color and forget the grid and to hell with the order. Photos from the Gagosian Gallery, Los Angeles, Diane von Furstenberg and Barry Diller, Kanye West and Flea, Damien Hirst, Curly Kloss and Derek Blasberg above the crowd, Tom Ford and Lisa Eisner, Frank Gehry and Anthony Kiedis. Photos from the Armory Show in New York, Mira and Don Rubel, Yvonne Force Villarreal, Jeffrey Deitch, artist Maurizio Catalan and J.R., and Paul Rudd.
Thank you.
Suits Me. Behold the steady appeal of Suits, the USA Network high-stakes drama that launched Meghan Markle, whose character, paralegal Rachel, walks down the aisle a month before that other wedding. By James Walcott. Opening photo illustration by Matt Chase. Raising the bar, Suits cast members Patrick J. Adams, Gina Torres, Gabriel Macht, Meghan Markle, Rick Hoffman, and Sarah Rafferty. When the royal engagement of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle was announced in November of 2017, USA Today declared that Markle will be the most atypical royal bride ever, with Wallis Simpson flaring her tiny nostrils coming in a furious second. Markle is a multi-precedent shatterer. She will make history as the first American, the first actress, and the first biracial person, though some historians contend that Queen Charlotte, married to King George III, may have been the first to break precedent, to be welcomed into the British royal family, most likely as a royal duchess with the Her Royal Highness title, which is ducky, but for some of us the most salient, piquant, and relatable item on Markle's resume is her role as Eagle paralegal Rachel Zane for 7 seasons on Suits, where she pored over briefs with a luminosity lit from within. That's how we came to know Markle. It's why we feel a proprietary zing of pride denied the uninitiated. In my extensive travels on mass transit, I have met civilians, many of them fine citizens in other respects, who not only have never watched Suits, but have never heard of it. Or, and this is far more common, who caught the show during its early seasons, lost track or interest at some point, and ask, "Is that thing still on?" It was on their radar, slid off, and they assumed it had disappeared into the ether. Understandable. I'm that way about Dance Moms, disgracefully unaware that Abby Lee Miller went to prison. Television viewership has become so fractionalized, the choice is so myriad and overwhelming, that even a popular long-running series such as Suits can recede into the pixelized wallpaper. Astute TV observers periodically lament that the series, whose 7th season's second half and Markle's last returned on March 28th, has never hit the sweet spot of cult acclaim or aroused the sort of critical rapture to raise it to the next tier. It's never entered national lore like The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, and Game of Thrones, nor set off a string of OMG firecrackers, as happens regularly in Shondaland. This, however, is not a flaw, but a feature. Created by Aaron Korsh, a former investment banker, Suits stays in its own lane and steadily zooms. It isn't trying to reinvent the medium, alter consciousness, and push the boundaries of what's acceptable. It's so far avoided the temptation to go meta, sparing us an all-musical episode or a soppy It's a Wonderful Life-inspired holiday treat. Some of its limitations are inherent in the primary specs. For openers, Suits is on Basic Cable's USA Network, which gives it less leeway to get as sweary, scatological, bare-skinned, and sado-explicit as the pay cable or subscription series on HBO, Showtime, Stars, Amazon Prime, and Netflix that push the envelope until it squeaks. Moreover, USA Network initially became identified with a subgenre of rakish action-adventure series that adhere to a specific aesthetic and target an affluent upper-middle-brow audience looking for jaunty escapism, a spa resort for tired eyes. Burn Notice, White Collar, the series that broke Matt Bomer into national heartthrob territory, Royal Pains, handsome and well-groomed, these USA Network successes were the opposite of noir. They're blanc as can be, vitamin-enriched. Suits is like those series, only more so. It's writing, directing, acting, and staging honed to a dapper syncopation. It shows how much you can achieve when pretension doesn't get in the way. Set in the gleaming, spotless, glass-walled, high-rise corporate terrarium of a Manhattan law firm, but shot in Toronto, Suits manages to achieve an abstract formalism without looking sterile or alienated, like some allegorical vampire chronicle of late capitalism. In contrast to Starz, The Girlfriend Experience, where every sinisterly immaculate hotel suite hints at some Michael Haneke horror about to unfold, its humor helps keep everything lubed. The cast has finessed the knack of delivering epigrammatic quips and clever comebacks while barely moving their lips, streamlining screwball comedy to a minimalist art. Conversations and quarrels are staged as a series of strategy moves and showdowns between bespoke Jedi, their bodies planted in dueling modes. The men, clad in power suits that look electrically rechargeable, stand tall and straight. The women, weaponized in power heels, stand equally vertical, meeting the men laser eye to laser eye. Suits is an ongoing tournament of wit and cunning within the law firm, and with rival outfits seeking to poach and devour. As was Mad Men, with its ad men and women were shown, but its ad men and women were shown as far more prone to unconscious urges, petty vanities, pockets of soul sickness, whereas nearly everyone on Suits relies on executive function and Sherlock deduction. The characters may reveal doubts, guilts, and weak spots over a glimmering glass of wine, but they never wallow too long or deep in the mood swamps. They have spring action metabolisms. It's always go time. Conquest in Suits isn't over power, or money, or justice, although all of these make things nicer in the cool of night. It's a constant jousting for status. The best restaurant table, the reserved parking spot, the corner office with the most panoramic view. These are the obvious status markers. True status is intangible. Some in Suits project like a beacon. Others have to fight for every little flicker. Cocksure Harvey, Gabriel Macht, the firm's alpha stud and Suits' leading corsair, and imperious queen bee Jessica Pearson, Gina Torres, exude unimpeachable high status, the latter possessing a haughty mien that makes her every line sound like an edict. Torres's Jessica is getting her own spin-off series on USA Network, transplanting her posh gravitas to the political wilds of Chicago. Every buttoned-tight series needs a destabilizer, and Suits is Louis Litt, Rick Hoffman, one of the all-time great television characters ever to escape captivity, where the other lawyers and their privileged clients appear poreless, cool to the touch. Louis seems equipped with high-productivity sweat glands. Where his colleagues are lean models of self-containment, their every stride purposeful, oval-shaped Louis moves like a jello mold learning to mambo, his eyes darty, his smile nervous, rabbity, and often needy, his face a mobile unit of conflicting impulses, some of them pervy. This sketch may make Louis sound like a neurotic Shrek in high-priced threads, the show's designated slob, but his mannerisms are every bit as stylized as the crisp edges of his colleagues and rivals. Hoffman dots the I of every tick twitch. Despite Louis's high-status position at the company, his pressurized behavior, the bullying, the wheedling, The churning digestive system and head wagging betrays lower status defensiveness. Which brings us to Mike, Patrick J. Adams, whose pinpoint double takes make him the Michael Keaton of his generation, and Rachel Markle, the show's rom-drom, love bugs, and junior contenders. From their meet-cute in the series plot, he as a new inductee at the firm, she is the paralegal delivering an orientation spiel and showing him to his cubicle, their guidance systems are aligned even as they spar. She accuses him of ogling her, which he was. He parries by pegging her as a stuck-up who considers herself too smart to be a paralegal, which she does. And at one point, her hips hump off out of frame and Mike mutters, almost in a stage whisper, "I love you," registering her force of impact. He knows he's a goner. One of the adhesive strips that bind them, apart from their being young, attractive, spiffily attired, her tight skirts and crisp white blouses evoking the semiotics of Japanese teacher erotica, and darts champions of flirty repartee, is the deeper affinity of toiling as underdogs, nagged by the laboring fear of not being good enough. Or the fear of feeling that others feel you're not good enough, which amounts to the same thing in the haunted valley of unbillable hours. They're pricklingly aware of how smart they are and how hard they work, but that's not enough to cut it on the Diamond Isle of Manhattan if you don't possess the proper sheepskins and letters of rec. When Mike was hired by Harvey on a roguish whim, Mike was not a licensed attorney. A goodwill hunting whiz kid equipped with near superpower eidetic memory, Mike faked his law school credentials, taking other aspirants' LSATs for them and acing them until he got caught. Given a shot to make good, he vows to Harvey, "You give me this, and I will work as hard as it takes to school those Harvard douches, and I'll be the best goddamn lawyer you've ever seen." Harvey, Harvard, such echoes are not incidental. Rachel, whose father, Robert, played by Wendell Pierce, is a Bigfoot lawyer who drives a menacing Range Rover, bears the stigma of failing to get admitted to Harvard Law School, a source of much Sturm und Drang and testy overcompensation. Next photo, legal union, Markle and Adams working late in a scene from Suits. So, Mike and Rachel complement each other, or if you're looking for a schmaltzier verb, complete each other. He's fake Harvard, excellent at taking test. She's failed Harvard, lousy at taking test. And both suffer from number two ranking to an alpha male. Mike in his role as Harvey's protege, the Robin to his Batman. Rachel overshadowed by her gruff powerhouse dad. After much storyline foreplay and well-timed frustrators, an intense kiss in the office is interrupted by Louis, that brute. The deflection shields are finally discarded in the concluding episode of season two, when Mike reveals his scalding secret to Rachel in that most romantic of locations, the file room. "I never went to Harvard. I'm a fraud." Rachel upsides him with a stinging slap twice, the cue for them to cast away inhibitions and restrictive items of clothing and make love with a wildcat passion that fortunately doesn't require a Harvard diploma. Otherwise, the human species might perish from being, like, really conceited. In the two-hour season finale, scheduled for April 25th, Mike and Rachel will enter into holy television matrimony, a surefire ratings winner wedding that will close a major chapter in Suits and tee up the royal wedding on May 19th, a much more lavish fairy tale to do. A number of Markle's castmates from Suits will reportedly be attending the ceremony, completing the cross-pollination effect. Their presence may not carry the Klieg-like candle power of Grace Kelly's wedding to Prince Rainier of Monaco in 1956, the original docking of Hollywood and European royalty, whose guest list included Cary Grant, Ava Gardner, and Gloria Swanson. But television is the pervasive medium through which everything is refracted, and Ava Gardner's don't grow on trees. As if the TV entertainment real-life overlap of the wedding itself weren't enough, on May 13th, the Lifetime cable channel is rolling out an original movie, Harry and Meghan, A Royal Romance, which, based on the coy kissy-poo teaser trailer, looks like quite a cheese platter. Once the festivities are but a fond afterglow, Season 8 of Suits will have to proceed without Mike, Rachel, and Jessica. It will be either a fresh reboot or a franchise on its last spindly legs. Until then, raise a toast to the royal couple and wish those two kids luck. Unless, of course, you happen to be a staunch anti-monarchist, in which case, kindly keep your scowl to yourself. Now here's a Vanity Fair Spotlight by Laura Jacobs, Fab Four, with photograph by Jason Bell. Little Women's March Sisters, Willa Fitzgerald, Meg, Maya Hawke, Joe, Catherine Newton, Amy, and Anne Elwaite, Beth, photographed at Mount John House in Newcastle, Ireland. Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, her beloved classic of 1868, saw five film adaptations in the 20th century, two silent movies circa 1917 and 1918, and three Hollywood feature films, 1933, 1949, and 1994, each one starring the darlings of its day. This May, on PBS, in a two-part masterpiece series directed by Vanessa Caswell and boasting its most book-true rendering yet, Little Women leaps to the screen once more. Written by Heidi Thomas, who is known for female-centric storytelling, Cranford, Call the Midwife, this project was, Thomas says, an invitation I'd been waiting for most of my writing life. And the idea of 3 hours, it's luxurious. I felt I could do what was right by the book and by all four sisters. And so she has. Previous films focused on boyish Joe at the expense of Meg, Beth, Amy, and their mother, Marmy. But this version goes deeper into all five characters, as did Alcott. Meg's envy, Beth's fear, Amy's airs, Marmy's hidden turbulence, and Joe's ambivalence, all are brought forward with a clarity that breathes complexity into the women and makes them feel more contemporary. I started the process of adapting it, says Thomas, thinking I knew all the March sisters as intimate friends, and I realized I hardly knew them at all. The fact that the young actresses cast as the sisters are mostly unknown, Maya Hawke, the daughter of Uma Thurman, and Ethan Hawke, makes her small screen debut as Jo, only adds to the updated dynamics. Meanwhile, Emily Watson is dream casting as Marmy. Angela Lansbury's Aunt March as a hoot, taffeta, and vinegar. And Jonah Hauer, King as Laurie Lawrence, the boy next door, well, it's dimples for days. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.